Succession number 27309, Reel 4.
Peter Duke, Reel 4. You were just describing an incident that occurred while you were flying at Jacksonville.
Yes, I'd flown the aeroplane for about 4 days on a few familiarisation hops and things, and climbed into it, this particular one, and on this particular day, and lined up at the end of the runway and for takeoff, and opened the throttle full open, of course, and took off. And when I'd climbed to 500 feet probably, I throttled back and, in the usual manner. But unfortunately, when I pulled the throttle back, nothing happened. The throttle had become disconnected from the carburetors inside the engine. Not at the quadrant where I have the lever. That was still connected to the rod, but the rod disappeared into somewhere and had fallen off. So there I was, climbing at a rate of knots. And not being able to stop the engine, turn it to throttle back. So I called up the tower and told them of the predicament, and I think they were a bit, didn't quite know what to say or what to do. After all, I'd only flown the thing for a couple of hours. they got my instructor onto the phone, who was very good, and he said, well, you better take it out to sea, because Jackson was on the coast. Take it out to sea and bail out and let it go, because you're not going to be able to land anywhere with that. And I said, well, hang on, can't we surely think of something else without wasting a perfectly good aeroplane? And eventually he told me what to do, to pull it up into a steep climb and then put the air brakes down. As the speed drops off, you can put the air brakes down and they'll hold. And that will reduce your speed, and various settings of the prop and the mixture and one thing and another. We gradually got the speed down a bit, but it was still pretty fast. And so he said, well, now fly over that town over there, I can't remember what it was, but which was quite familiar, and when you get over the church spire at 3,000 feet, switch the engine off. Actually, the switching the engine off is not a very good idea, because the prop will still be windmill. With the wind, will turn the prop, and it might catch fire. This was one of the biggest problems, that it quite possibly would catch fire. So I did what I was told. I switched the engine off, and I glided down towards the runway, and perfectly happy. I thought, well, this is all right, and I landed it, and everything was seen to be fine. The only trouble was I didn't have any power, so I couldn't go anywhere from when I'd landed. And as I looked round thinking, what do I do next, there was the two crash wagons, a fire engine, three ambulances, the duty officer on the motorbike, all chasing after me down the runway. And I was wondering what the problem was. But at the time, looking back, it really was a bit scary, I must admit. Perhaps if I'd had more experience with the plane, I could have... I did all right in the end, as it was, but I don't know.
Well, we left you just joining Victorious on the 27th of February 1945 in Sydney, and the ship sailing instantaneously.
Yeah.
When you joined Victorious, did you join a squadron on Victorious at that point?
Yes, 1834.
Are there any members of that squadron who you remember well?
No. Yes. We still some of us around. Not down here. There's Johnny Maybank. He was on the Victorious. Charles Leddy, who died a couple of years ago of natural causes. Gordon Showell. He was 1834 squadron on the Victorious. Yes, there are a few of us around still. Dickie Martin, he lives in Essex somewhere. So there's some of us around.
And how long had the squadron been with Victorious when you joined?
I have no idea.
But it had been for some time?
Yes, it had. 1834 and 1836 were the two Corsair squadron already there. And they wanted replacement pilots for whatever reason. And that's how we were sent over there. Double quick time. the last minute.
And what's the strength of a Corsair squadron on board an aircraft carrier?
36 aircraft altogether. Not a squadron, the two Corsair squadrons were 36 operational aircraft. So there were probably a few spare planes, possibly. And then, of course, there was an Avenger squadron, also on the Vic, with that their attendant replacements or spares or whatever. So the complement of the Victorias in aircraft must have been, what, about 60? Something like that.
And would there be spare pilots for each squadron at that? You wouldn't at that time, it would be...
No, but we didn't all fly all the time. Yes, but spare pilots in as much as you want 12 aircraft in the air and you've got 18 pilots in the squadron. So you've got spare in that way. But we didn't actually take it in turns. Another thing about operating from a carrier, relative to the RAF people, or even things like Barracudas, which my friend John flew, and he had a team of ground crew, and he knew who the ground crew were, and although they were ratings, they got on well together, and he knew each one for whatever job he did, and he used to discuss the plane or whatever. Now, on a carrier, you don't get that liaison because you don't fly your aircraft; you fly an aircraft. And it depends which aircraft is at the whatever end of the ship you want to put it on. It is ranged on the flight deck, a range of 24 aircraft or 10 aircraft, whatever it is. And you are detailed to go and fly one of the 10 aircraft, and you sort of say, well, more or less take as you get to them. You fly this one, you fly that one. So you never know. You never get to know the people responsible for that aircraft. Equally, they probably didn't work on an airplane. They worked on an airplane that happened to come along, which wanted servicing, or as they did, of course. And so you never got this liaison between the ground crews and the pilots on a carrier, except generally, but not like you did on shore station, particularly in the RAF, of course.
How was your operational flying organised on the carrier? Who directs it, and how are you briefed for operations?
Well, Commander Flying was in charge, and then he would delegate Lieutenant Commander Flying, who was an awfully nice bloke. He was Lieutenant Commander RN. He started the war as a Lieutenant Commander RN, he finished the war as Lieutenant Commander RN. Now that takes a bit of doing. And his name was Sykes, I think. In fact, I'm sure it was. And he would then organise the Admiral of the Fleet would say, we're going in to such and such an area where we've been asked to attack such and such a target. Okay, so then Commander Flying would liaise with Lieutenant Commander Flying, say, right, we will arrange or fly a squadron of Avengers escorted by Corsairs or, squadron of whatever. And he would then designate the various people to fly various aircraft, looking down to see, well, he's already flown three times today, this fellow hasn't done it, flown today, so he can go for a start, or whatever. However, and that's how it was sort of, generally speaking, organised.
Would you be briefed where you're going?
Oh yes. And then they got us down into the briefing room, which was the midshipman's gun room. That's right. And that was our briefing room. And told what the target was and what to do when we got there and what to avoid and what to, whatever. And what the weather was going to be and everything else. And then we'd dash up to the flight deck and climb into. I think we may have been, because all the aircraft had a big letter on the tail, A, B, and on the fuselage, A, B, C. And I think he'd probably been told by the deck handling party that the following aircraft are arranged, A, B, C, D, and E. And he'd probably say, right, you take A, you take B, you take... I think that was... Because otherwise it might have been a sort of free-for-all. So you then went straight for your own aircraft, or the one you designated to fly. I think that's how it must have been done. I can't remember quite, but... and so you hopped in and off you went. And also, of course, it might have been 1834, it might have been 1836. Pilot who was going to fly. We were all sort of mixed up by that time. Especially as we'd lost a few one way or another. So we had to make do with what we had left.
So with the Victorious, you sailed northwards, could you, from Sydney up into the
We went straight up to Manus in the Admiralty Islands, where we stopped for a day, which was a big American base. Actually, it was quite... We did go ashore there just to get a milkshake, because, of course, all American naval stuff is dry. And when we get there ashore, we noticed that all these... it had been built by the Americans, the whole place. There was nothing there before, but it did belong to Australia. And all of the roads and everything that had been laid down, and all these jeeps tearing about, and they all drove on the English or Australian side of the road, because it was an Australian territory. But they were all on the wrong side from their point of view. You'd have thought that there was nothing else there, nobody else except the American fleet and all the support, and yet they drove on the Australian side of the road. I thought that was fun. And then from there we went up to the... I think we went straight up to the operating area, didn't we? Off Okinawa. Because the Americans had just invaded Okinawa. And our job was to stop them moving aircraft from the Japanese mainland to Okinawa.
Is this where you joined the 5th Fleet,
The American 5th Fleet.
Yeah.
And we were told what to do by the 5th Fleet. Admiral Nimitz, or Admiral Halsey, I think it was Nimitz. And we were entirely under there. And of course, their ships were, as everybody knows, had wooden flight decks. And so when they were attacked and hit by these kamikazes, which were just beginning to be a bloody nuisance, they would penetrate their flight decks. And then they had an armoured hangar deck, but that's not much use, because by that time, the whole place is on fire, obviously. So we had armour-plated decks, and they couldn't get through them. And we were always... Our British Pacific Fleet was always attached to the American fleet, was always stationed nearest to the enemy, if you see what I mean. Because you don't arrange the fleet parallel with the coastline, whatever it may be. You obviously arrange it 90 degrees on. So as you're not such a big target for anybody or anything. But we were always stationed at the front end. So if any kamikazes came along, they've got to pass us first.
With your operations, obviously you said that you were there to stop the flow of Japanese aircraft reinforcing Okinawa. What type of operations would you be doing to do that? Would that just be patrolling?
Bombing them. There were only... it was called the Sakishima Gunto, which is a range of very small islands between Formosa, Okinawa and Japan. And they'd staged the aircraft through the Sakishima group and then on to Okinawa. Well, all we did was to either catch them coming in, hopefully not going out, or disturbing them on the ground, bombing the runways or any facilities that they may have had there, which was pretty basic, but they were operating from there. And we had to stop them operating from there.
So it would be for your... Would your squadron do ground attack in that role, or would that be the Avengers?
Well, I think ground attack... Well, the Avengers, of course, did a lot of that sort of work. But we did as well, and stop them by whatever means. If they're in the air, or this, we have a signal that... Because we had picket destroyers in front of the fleet give wider radar cover, because radar cover was very limited in those days, and they could detect some aircraft doing something, and they'd radio back that, you know, we picked up a whole lot of something coming somewhere. And we'd go off and investigate and shoot them down if they were going to the group, the Sakishima, or bomb the runways anyway. But of course they, just like we did in England, they bombed these runways which were grass or dirt or shingle or sand or whatever. And then overnight they'd come along and the workforce would fill them in with a lot of shovels, and it would be operational again next morning, so you've got to go and do it all over again. They weren't concrete runways or tarmac or anything. It easily made a hole in, but it equally easily filled in. So it was an ongoing job.
When you were attacking, say, a target like an airfield, are there any sort of techniques that you use on that? I mean, I'm thinking, do you attack, do you make one pass and then leave? Or?
Yes, you certainly do. You never go back. Don't go back. You can go back if you do a completely different direction, or, you know, so, on possibly a time lapse as well. But people, quite a number of people, were shot down because they made a run and they turned around and they came back to make another run, and that's when they used to catch them. You make one run only and get the hell out of it.
And how would you...
Mind you, there's a lot of anti-aircraft fire, of course, on the ground. And that was quite severe at times.
How would you approach, say you were attacking an airfield, how would you do your attack?
Well, partly directed by the sun, where the sun is, and come out of the sun if possible, if any sun. And that was the main thing to do, and also the wind direction and direction of anti-aircraft, where they were sighted. You know, don't give them a good shot at you.
Would you come in at a steep dive, or would you come in at low level?
I think we used to go down at low level on a target like that. Because it didn't really matter if you didn't hit the runway, you hit something else, and anything you hit would disrupt them.
Do you present less of a target really at low level than if they see you diving from a certain height? Would you is that in your favour, coming at a low level attack?
Well, a low level attack was in our favour as much as it made it more difficult for them to shoot at you, which was the main reason. We had photo recce, been over there before, and we'd had photographs of the place and of the runways, and we used to be able to, before we went, we'd know what we were looking at. And then, of course, we were sent up to on combat air patrols to keep the kamikazes away.
Were there any instances, obviously, where you had air-to-air combat yourself during these operations?
Yes. Once or twice I wrote them in my logbook, but not very often.
Have you got any memories of those occasions?
I remember shooting down a Dyna, a thing called a Dyna, which was a twin engine, actually. That was toddling along and didn't see us. We saw him, and we attacked him, and he didn't know what had happened, I don't think. And he went into the sea with great joy.
Which angle had you attacked him from?
Well, we were above him. Because we used to do patrols at a pretty high altitude, high for us. I mean, 20,000 feet air patrol was nothing unusual. And that's where a Corsair was brilliant, because it could get up there. It took a fair while, mind you, but it could get there. A Seafire, I think its operational ceiling was about 14,000 or something. Even if it could get to 20,000 feet, it had to come back again, because it had used up all its fuel. And so they couldn't do CAPs, which is called combat air patrols, except at low level, of which they were brilliant. But most of ours were done at high altitude to get right above any attack. And then we could see them, and they couldn't see us, probably. And it wasn't exactly a turkey shoot, mind you, as Americans would call it.
I was thinking as well, actually, during these combat air patrols, obviously you're operating with the Americans. How were the aircraft marked? What was your camouflage and what were your markings at that time? Were they...
The American Corsairs we flew were like that model, actually, that one there, blue, with duck egg blue underneath. But the ones we had, most of ours, were camouflaged, like the other model I've got there. They were camouflaged. I don't know the reason for one or the other.
That didn't ever present any problems, obviously, operating... I'm thinking of maybe friendly fire incidents or accidental...
Well, the only friendly fire people used to shoot at us were the battleships. And they frequently... they couldn't tell a Corsair from a pigeon. They were terrible people. Especially a lone aircraft, if you had to come back for some reason, whatever reason, you had to come back to the ship on your own, and probably approach the fleet from an unknown angle, and they'd see a single aircraft coming, all hell would break loose.
This period, was when you were dealing with the aircraft flying to Okinawa, was this Operation Iceberg?
Iceberg. That was Okinawa, yeah. And this is a chart here of the various Operation Iceberg, 26th of March to 25th of May, operational flying. The undermentioned are the Corsair pilots and the Avenger pilots who flew Operation Sorties throughout the whole operation. Between them, they accounted for more than two-fifths of the total operation flying from the Victorias. I especially commend these officers and thank them for their arduous work, the fine results obtained, and the good fortune that attended them. And I'm on the list here. I flew more than anybody else. I flew 90 hours and 10 minutes. No, there's one fellow who flew 90 hours and 20 minutes. But that was more, we two were far more flying than any of the others. Just for no other reason, I think.
When you're doing your combat air patrols, what kind of length of time would you be up in the air for those?
4 hours. Three hours. Depends on how lucky you were.
Is that tiring?
Very. Because you've got to keep your eyes peeled in all directions all the time. And that is very tiring, you know.
Is it physically hard to fly the aircraft as well after that period?
No. You can set it up. Like you can set up even a Cherokee or something. You set up the tabs and things and it'll fly itself. People think flying an aeroplane is, you've got to do it every second. You've got to be doing something. It's not true. You've got to get it up in the air and you've got to get it down again. But when you're up there just going from A to B, you do practically nothing. You just keep on a course. If it's straying off course, you would correct it and that sort of thing. But you don't do any more than you would in a car going down a motorway. And it'll fly itself.
And during Operation Iceberg, are there other sort of incidents that come to mind of specific incidents that occurred?
Well, it was. I don't think it was routine. It sounds a sort of funny word to use, but you know, it was. You did that particular sort of work and did it again tomorrow. And as long as you didn't get shot down or crash land or something, and you got down to a ship okay, on landed, it was just like any other day.
Yeah. Was there a number of casualties amongst the pilots operating at that time?
Yes, we lost quite a few, really. Some of them from crashes on deck. Most of them survived, but some of them didn't. But quite a small number, sort of about, I don't know how many, but were lost in combat. You know, we used to lose them. Luckily, I got back every time, luckily.
Was that mainly to the anti-aircraft fire you mentioned?
It mainly from anti-aircraft fire, yes.
Rather than Japanese?
And they had a system of I don't know what you'd call it, really, but it was sort of radar-controlled gun laying. So once if you were flying at 10,000 feet over land, which, of course, mainly we were, now, having got off the ship to that... you got to alter course and height every, I think it was 6 seconds. because if you flew straight and level, they'd pick you up with this gun laying system they had, not laser those days, but something or other, and they were dead accurate. So every six seconds or 9 seconds, you had to not only alter course and jinx or something, but also altitude. That's very tiring. You know, you're flying for 2 or 3 hours over Japan or somewhere, over the islands or whatever it is, and then they couldn't normally hit you. But if you stopped, think, oh, I've solved that, I'm just they'd catch you. They really were. They were very good at it.
You mentioned also at this time that it was the start of the Japanese kamikaze attacks. Have you got any memories of those attacks? I mean, you mentioned obviously earlier on about them sweeping the decks of the British carriers. Yeah. But did you see, obviously, attacks on American carriers and British?
No. I never saw American. We hardly ever saw the American fleet. I mean, visual contact with a fleet is, what, 20 miles? 25 miles at the very most? And we were further than that away from them. Because it was quite a big fleet, and we were strung out as far as possible, still keeping within range of whatever we were trying to do. I never saw the Japanese attacking the American fleet. They attacked us, and that was enough.
Can you describe what would happen with the kamikaze attacks? For obviously, people are not aware of what actually happens when they did.
Well. I still think in the back of my mind that if we were attacked by the kamikazes, which we were, it was our fault. Our being fighter pilots, because we were supposed to be there to protect the fleet from kamikazes. And if they got through, which they did on occasions, you can't shoot them all down, then why didn't we stop them? Sounds easy, but it wasn't that easy. Yes.
Can you remember any instances where they attacked Victorious?
Oh, yes. I landed on, actually, from whatever reason, probably with the rest of us. And there was suddenly a red alert, because these chaps used to turn up from nowhere, funnily enough. You know, all of a sudden, there's two or three of them would appear without warning. And a red alert, quick, so I just landed on. Undid my harness and parachute and left the parachute in the plane and jumped out and into the catwalk, which is the walk on either side of the flight deck. And no sooner did I sort of scramble along the flight deck than this thing hit us. And it hit my aircraft that I'd just got out of. And I'd left my parachute in the plane. Now, there was something about parachutes during the war. I think it was because they used to pinch them and cut them up and give them to them for the nylon stockings or something. And whatever you do, don't lose your parachute. Don't leave it behind. You must have your parachute. Of course, mine was just went up with the plane. And when I went down to, even on the ship, went down to store, said, I've lost my parachute, and can I have another one? Oh. Yes, sir. Now, how did you lose it? When did you last see it? As if I'd given it to somebody ashore, you know. It took quite a while for me to get another parachute.
What did it feel like, though, to be at the receiving end of the kind of kamikaze attack?
Pardon?
What did it feel like to be at the receiving end of the kamikaze attack?
Well, they did a certain amount of damage, of course. If they didn't hit the centre of the ship, either side, they would go through, but there was not hangar or anything underneath, so nothing too serious. And one hit the catapult on the forward, port side forward, where we had those the 4.5 guns, and they hit just right there, and they went through that chemical. They actually went through into the mess deck or something below, and that killed quite a lot of people of ship's company, you know? But it also put the catapult out of action, for which we were quite pleased, because that was a dreadful shot off on the catapult. Wasn't everybody's idea of fun.